You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, February 13th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting... Excuse me, what... live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable... Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, you give us reaction to the State of the Union address last night. Adam Green from the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. And to give us a reaction to the rebuttal by Marco Rubio, the completely hydrated John Amato from Crooks and Liars. Also on the program today, apparently Harry Reid can break a hold by an individual senator when he wants to force a vote on a confirmation of a nominee. Also, Ron Paul attacks his supporters, and they fight back. Freedom! Also today, happening right at this moment, as we speak, ladies and gentlemen, tens of people are engaging in an act of civil disobedience, including my friend and co-host on Ring of Fire, Bobby Kennedy, as well as representatives from the Sierra Club in their first civil action or act of civil disobedience in 120 years. There are ranchers from the Midwest, farmers from the Midwest who are being arrested, environmental activists who are going to get arrested, all part of an act of civil disobedience to protest Keystone Pipeline XL. Relevant, even more relevant today, last night President Obama, and we'll talk more about this as the show progresses, but last night President Obama said, if the Congress does not act to deal with the crisis of climate change, then he will issue executive orders to slow the growth and cut back on the growth, perhaps, of the release of CO2s into the atmosphere. We will talk about the fact that these things don't have to be mutually exclusive, that the president could have announced last night some type of executive action to complement the action that he hopes will take place in Congress. And he certainly has the ability to stop what has been called by the chief climatology expert at NASA, James Hansen, Keystone XL, which would be game over for our fights to stop the rise in global temperatures. So he could take that action. It almost is not even in an executive action. It is simply the course in which the State Department must issue a permit for this pipeline to cross the Canadian-U.S. border, and they can simply decide that there are compelling reasons not to issue that permit. So we will see. But as we speak, people are being arrested in an act of civil disobedience in front of the White House. We will have more on that in the coming days. But first, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Adam Green of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone with me is the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which you can find at boldprogressives.org, Adam Green. Adam, welcome to the program.
Hey, big fan of the program. Good to be here, Sam.
Well, thank you, Adam. I'm a big fan of yours. I think you know that. I just want to check that you're totally hydrated. If you need to take a water break at any time, feel free. Just continue to look into the phone.
Sounds great.
Adam.
You should be a comedian.
Well, yeah, I've been told that. I've also been told I shouldn't be. So that balances it out. All right, let's start. Now, I want to get to, after we talk, let's first start with the State of the Union. And then I want to also talk about a campaign that you guys are involved in. Well, you're involved in a bunch of them, but one dealing with Mitch McConnell. But let's also just start with the campaign that you guys are involved in basically making sure that any deal that is cut relative to avoiding the sequester, or any deal, I guess, at that point, does not involve cuts to benefits to Medicare or Social Security. It was announced by the president's spokesperson the other day that the cuts to Medicare in the form of raising eligibility age were off the table. To our understanding, cuts to Social Security via the so-called change CPI is still on the table. I want to play a clip of the president last night that where he deviated from his prepared text. And I want you to just we'll just talk about that. This is President Obama talking about the idea that we wouldn't raise any revenues, but we would cut Medicare or Social Security. Let's play this.
To hit the rest of our deficit reduction target, we should do what leaders in both parties have already suggested and save hundreds of billions of dollars by getting rid of tax loopholes and deductions for the well-off and the well-connected. After all, why would we choose to make deeper cuts to education and Medicare just to protect special interest tax breaks? How is that fair? Why is it that deficit reduction is a big emergency, justifying making cuts in Social Security benefits but not closing some loopholes? How does that promote growth?
So, Adam, there was a line that was different from the prepared text in there that was added. Why is deficit reduction a big emergency justifying cuts in Social Security benefits but not closing some loopholes? Give me your analysis as to what that may or may not signal.
Yeah, that line could be read a couple of ways. And I guess some context is that, you know, this president is very, very good at choosing his words. Right. So he'll get up in front of a crowd and say, we must not slash Social Security benefits, and everybody will applaud. But slashing is different from cutting or trimming or tweaking, right?
Right.
Most people would not interpret that as opening up a line of threat against Social Security, but those who are actually following it carefully would see that. This line last night, why is it the deficit reduction is a big emergency justifying cuts in Social Security benefits, not closing some loopholes? That sounds like he's saying we should close loopholes. We shouldn't cut Social Security benefits. But the way it's actually constructed is, why is it that deficit reduction is a big emergency justifying cuts in Social Security benefits? He's almost saying that as truth, but not closing some loopholes. It essentially could be read as lining up, one of his balanced approach ideas, which is if we're going to cut Social Security benefits, we must also close loopholes. And that's in the context of this truth that I'm saying, which is this is an emergency justifying these cuts.
Right.
So it's a little bit scary. It's really scary because for activists like myself, it kind of demobilizes the troops, right? Most people read that and say, oh, he's great. But there's really a threat out there, and that's what we're worried about.
And this is the point. I know that some people will say we're being a little bit nitpicky here, and there was a lot to be commended in that speech overall, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But this is something that is – this is something that you folks have been following for quite a while, and I've been following for quite a while. We know that since January of 2009, the president has expressed some desire for a grand bargain. Now, the optimist in me looks at this and says, "We know what an anathema to raising revenues is to the Republicans." And so in some ways, what the president could be saying is, I'm going to indicate that the deficit is a crisis, even though the vast majority of economists say, no, in fact, it is not a crisis. In fact, we need to expand it to expand economic growth. But aside from that, it's also perhaps his way of saying, like, well, I'm willing to put our sacred cows on the table. If you're willing to put your sacred cows on the table, all the while knowing that he's not going to do this, that they're not going to put those sacred cows on the table.
Yeah. I mean, that's an often made argument. And, there's two flaws in that for me, or at least two things I'm very wary of. I mean, one is, essentially saying he's going to give away the farm, for argument's sake, put really important stuff like Social Security benefits that my grandma and millions of grandparents across the country depend on the table, giving John Boehner the power to say yes, under the theory that John Boehner will say no and will look extreme, is a really big gamble, right? That's a gamble that I'm not willing to make, and I don't think most people would be willing to make to prove the point that John Boehner's extreme. Point number two is that our sacred cows are better than their sacred cows, right? Our sacred cows are 80% or more popular. Their sacred cows, like tax cuts for the rich and tax cuts for the powerful, are wildly unpopular. So it's not like, the left has their sacred cows, the right has their sacred cows, they're equally popular, let's both put it on the table in the interest of moving the country forward. There's pretty much zero issue on the table right now where the progressive position is not the most popular position by overwhelming numbers. And therefore, why not just rally the public behind what progressives are demanding as opposed to needlessly compromising? That's pretty much our position. The one thing I would say is that there's – and it's something I know you've addressed a million times. The key word is benefits. So if Republicans come to the table in good faith and say our concern is really spending, it's not – we're not actively trying to cause pain. We're not actively trying to reduce people's dependence on government. We just want to get our fiscal house in order. And our response is, great, let's save $130 billion by letting Medicare and Medicaid negotiate prices with the drug companies. And if we want to achieve savings in those entitlement programs by getting rid of basically the corporations ripping off taxpayers, then great. We can all agree to that, right? So the word entitlements is the wrong word. It's the word benefits. But what it seems like is that Republicans actively want to cause pain for people and make them have less faith in the government. And that's what we have to stand against.
And I will extend your second point, not just about it being a risky thing to put on the table, but look, the president had a very, on balance, a very progressive agenda that he laid out in this speech. and very little of it is going to be able to pass as the government is currently constructed. We know that the Republicans are going to obstruct virtually all of these policies. That is what they do. So at the end of the day, the aspects of this speech that I liked were that he was basically setting the compass in the proper direction. He was presenting a progressive and liberal vision in many different areas of our life. And I applaud that. But the idea that he would float the idea of cutting Social Security benefits is pushing the compass in the wrong direction. So to the extent that we can appreciate all the other things that we're going to go through in this speech, we have to necessarily take issue with the compass going in the wrong direction in terms of Social Security benefits. I mean, that to me seems, self-evident. You can't enjoy the speech for its rhetorical power and for its being a bully, the use of a bully pulpit, without seeing the use of the bully pulpit functioning to undercut the legitimacy of Social Security. That's my little bailiwick there. But let's move on to the other aspects of the speech. What struck out for you? What really struck you as positive in the speech?
There was a ton that was positive in the speech. And I think you put quite well the tension between wanting to celebrate the good and being wary of the bad. Jobs was great. Minimum wage was great. Education was great. We could talk about all those. But the one that stood out most to me was the super emotional, super impactful gun moment, where he said, Gabby Giffords deserves a vote. The victims of Newtown deserve a vote. The victims of Aurora deserve a vote.
Clip. Let's play that clip right now.
Idea's parents, Nate and Cleo, are in this chamber tonight, along with more than two dozen Americans whose lives have been torn apart by gun violence. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. Gabby Giffords deserves a vote. The families of Newtown deserve a vote. The families of Aurora deserve a vote. The families of Oak Creek and Tucson and Blacksburg and the countless other communities ripped open by gun violence, they deserve a simple vote. They deserve a simple vote.
I mean, I've watched a bunch of State of Union addresses. I don't know how many, but that was one of the most impressive moments I've seen in a State of the Union address, particularly one that wasn't sort of rallying around some type of nationalism, some type of argument mm-hmm. that we need to defeat our enemies. I don't know if I've ever seen anything quite like that.
Yeah, and that was called oratory. One of my kind of private critiques of the inaugural was that there were a lot of great progressive policies and kind of a nice laundry list of stuff, but I didn't feel too emotionally stirred. Last night, I felt emotionally stirred watching that, and that's what oratory is supposed to do. Now, what I love about that strategically is, first of all, side note, if you watch John Boehner during that part, for some reason, he happened to be standing when it began. And then Joe Biden is clapping and John Boehner doesn't clap. And then midway through that, John Boehner sits down, right? And I think that's actually symbolic of why that was so strategic. By asking for a vote, the president has managed to take something that is kind of a wonky, inside-the-beltway process issue of, does the House Speaker put something on the floor for a vote? Does the minority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, allow something to come to a vote as opposed to a filibuster, right? It's hard to engage people around those issues. But by picking the highly emotional issue of guns and choosing to use that as our best foot forward in addressing this process issue, and my guess is he'll barnstorm around the country calling for a vote, which just sounds so reasonable in the context of these victims deserving their fair chance at having some reforms, you know, this could be game changing, right? If John Boehner, who is not representing his constituents back home on this issue, and the same with Mitch McConnell, if they are forced to cave on this issue and allow votes, and Democratic votes are allowed to combine with a few Republican votes to pass this stuff into law, that sets a precedent for every future policy fight, right? It finally allows and it will allow the media to take credibly any time in the future that the president says, we need a vote on the minimum wage, we need a vote on this, because they will have seen with their own eyes the power of public pressure coupled with the emotional, you know, bully pulpit of the president making Republicans cave. It's just, to me, this could be a dream come true. So I'm really excited about his line of messaging, his ability to rouse people with that messaging, and I really hope that he takes that on the road. And groups like ours, I think, have an obligation to work with the president on this issue and make sure he's successful, because so much for our future issues are at stake in this fight.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think making it about just the opportunity to vote was brilliant. I mean, I watched a clip of Rubio on CBS this morning, and he was asked that question, and he cannot answer it. There is no way to answer the question, why shouldn't this be given a vote? Because the only way they can answer it is to say, well, because I don't want to take a vote and vote no and have the public see that I'm against it. I mean, it was just a brilliant move. And yes, it was an incredibly moving moment during the speech. I completely concur with you on that. Let's talk also about the climate change. The president addressed it, and I was left a little bit wanting here, and particularly today when people, as we speak, are being arrested outside the White House protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. Let's play this clip. This is number three of the president calling on Congress to do something about climate change and then saying, if you don't, well, here it is.
And over the last 4 years, our emissions of the dangerous carbon pollution that threatens our planet have actually fallen. But for the sake of our children and our future, we must do more to combat climate change. Now, it's true that no single event makes a trend. But the fact is, the 12 hottest years on record have all come in the last 15. Heat waves, droughts, wildfires, floods, all are now more frequent and more intense. We can choose to believe that Superstorm Sandy and the most severe drought in decades and the worst wildfires some states have ever seen were all just a freak coincidence. Or we can choose to believe in the overwhelming judgment of science and act before it's too late.
And he went on to say, Congress has to do some action. If it doesn't, then I'm going to do some action by executive order. Now, these things, it doesn't necessarily have to follow in that order, does it?
It doesn't have to follow in that order. I don't know the exact logic there, but I guess maybe the executive orders are more controversial, but he'll do it if he needs to. I don't know. But that was a brilliant part of his speech. Also, one of the things that we actually did a joint mini campaign with a new group called Forecast the Facts, which is a couple of really smart environmental organizers who are trying to get weathermen, meteorologists, to acknowledge in their weather reporting that climate change is relevant to what they're reporting on. And it was crazy watching this historic blizzard being covered on TV with almost no one acknowledging that fact. So the fact that the president used his megaphone to educate millions of people and get him to connect the dots, I think, is a really positive sign and a really good use of that bully pulpit.
Yeah, I was impressed by that too. It wasn't a poetic reference, the seas rising, whatnot. It was really a a very sort of, he delivered it well, but it was a very dry, data-driven plea for some type of action here. And I hope that he's setting the groundwork to basically say no to the Keystone XL pipeline, because if you believe the overwhelming scientific consensus, then you have to stop these tar sands from being exploited in this way, because it's just going to release so much carbon into the atmosphere that it's going to be, as James Hansen said, game over. Let's talk also about the minimum wage, because the president made a full-throated appeal for the minimum wage to be raised. Let's listen to that now. This is number four.
We know our economy is stronger when we reward an honest day's work with honest wages. But today, a full-time worker making the minimum wage earns $14,500 a year, even with the tax relief we put in place. A family with two kids that earns the minimum wage still lives below the poverty line. That's wrong. That's why, since the last time this Congress raised the minimum wage, 19 states have chosen to bump theirs even higher. Tonight, let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty, and raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour.
He went on to say that he wants to index it to inflation. What are the implications of this?
I mean, this is huge. I mean, first, again, this is where the bully pulpit matters so much. I mean, he's educating the nation on this stuff. I mean, how many people have actually made an argument for the minimum wage in the last 10 years in a way that broke through? I just inherent in him making that argument, I think, creates a new environment for minimum wage fights on the state level, which some great progressives on state level are actually pushing, and for the prospect of national legislation. I think that was the most important thing. There's also the fun element, again, of watching John Boehner during that part of the speech where he was just forced to listen. And while others were clapping, he refused to clap. To see this guy be told that someone working full time is living in poverty with their family and refuse to clap for giving that family, that hardworking family, a raise, I really think speaks volumes about the pro-worker side versus the anti-worker side of this country. So it's really meaningful. And again, yeah, I think progressives like us who have been rightly critical of this president in the past and are no yes men really want to nod our heads and applaud and say yes to this speech. And if only that Social Security thing were more tight and he took benefit cuts off the table, we could just be ebullient at the entire thing. But things like this, I think, do us proud and really set up a great environment for issue fights to come.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, because I want to talk about the campaign that you guys are running in Kentucky. But it seems to me what the president is setting up here is he's basically putting out a broader progressive vision with a lot of different elements to it across the board. He also talked about universal pre-K. Mm-hmm. He's talked about immigration. It seems to me that he is really focused on trying to set up, in a way that we haven't seen him do in the past, these midterm elections, because there's a lot of stuff there. If you're running for Congress against one of those Republicans, there's a lot of stuff for you to work with now.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Rachel Maddow actually made a really interesting point last night when it comes to the electoral element of this. She said that in states with a minimum wage hike on the ballot, A, they passed overwhelmingly, but B, Democratic-type voters tended to come out and increase voter performance for Democrats, similar to what Karl Rove did on the opposite side with gay marriage in 2004. So if that was his goal, if his goal was actually a shrewd political move, probably mission achieved, to the extent that candidates do what you just said, which is actually run on this issue in 2014. So. Now, good stuff all around.
Yeah. Now let's talk about another one of those issues. I mean, I think, obviously Mitch McConnell is feeling the heat, because he is one of those people who, along with Boehner, will basically be responsible for the lack of a vote on some type of reasonable gun control if a vote doesn't take place. I want to run an ad that I know you guys are, and we have a link to it on our site. You guys are trying to raise money to play this ad in Kentucky. Let's play the ad, and you tell us what the numbers are behind this, why you guys are taking this tact with McConnell.
I was born and raised right here in Kentucky. I served my country as a marksman, and we were trained to use guns safely. It's unthinkable that guns meant for war could be used on civilians and children. As a gun owner and veteran, I support the plan to ban assault weapons and keep guns out of the wrong hands, because I know these guns. I know what they can do. Senator Mitch McConnell is funded by the gun industry, and he opposes common sense reforms. Senator McConnell, whose side are you on?
Tell us about that ad. Why McConnell's district, and why gun control?
So, you know, our organization, boldprogressives.org, you know, wants to be bold, and we want to go on offense. You know, frankly, this Social Security and Medicare fight is a fight that we're in reluctantly, just out of necessity, but we don't want to really be fighting a Democratic president and Democratic Senate on the issue of Social Security, of all things. We want to move the country forward. And there are several issues that we plan on doing that on in 2013, but, you know, guns was one that was kind of handed to us, and we figured, especially since the president is doing what we've been advocating for as an organization for 4 years, leading boldly on the issue as opposed to cutting a deal with the big corporations and starting with his compromise position, and then making the case to the public, we want to help him go on offense and prove to him that progressives will be there getting his back, helping him win when he actually decides to confront the Republicans instead of prematurely caving. And who better to make an example out of than Mitch McConnell, who is, A, the most vulnerable Republican up for re-election in 2014, which is really fascinating, especially given that he's from Kentucky, and B, who is one of the biggest obstacles to any progress on any issue, given his role leading filibusters in the Senate. So, you know, at this point, we have over 120,000 people who have signed a petition supporting the White House plan. And over 20,000 of those people are gun owners. So it's actually up at our website, gunownersforreform.com. And we decided to dig into that a little bit, find some gun owners from Mitch McConnell's home state, and give them a chance to speak out. And, you know, it's funny because he tried to react to that by saying, oh, this is a liberal out-of-state group. And it's like, you know what? He can call us whatever he wants, but when people see one of their neighbors on TV, that doesn't really have credibility, right? And, you know, one other consequence of this debate is that there's a wedge being drawn between the NRA and their own members. And the NRA is being much more closely aligned with gun manufacturers who fund them than with actual gun owners on the ground. And in this ad, you know, most people couldn't see it visually, but we put on screen that Mitch McConnell has taken, you know, about $198,000 in help from the gun manufacturers in order to get him elected. And, you know, when we pose the question, whose side are you on, that is directly, you know, calling into doubt, you know, whether he supports his big campaign donors or not.
So why?
One other thing I'd mention is that, you know, we did a poll the week before we ran this ad, and in Kentucky, in the red state of Kentucky, 82% of voters support criminal background checks. Hmm. The assault weapons ban is also supported by the public. It's a little bit less. It's 50% to 40%. And by about a 50% to 30% margin, voters back home think that Mitch McConnell sides with his campaign donors more than siding with regular Kentucky families. So this ad is an attempt to hold him accountable back home and really start getting us on offense for a change instead of always playing defense.
So why is McConnell weak, A, and B, is the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, are they targeting this state as well?
To start with that one, they'd be crazy not to, again, just because the polling shows that he is the most vulnerable incumbent Republican. You know, there are efforts underway to lure Ashley Judd into running. You know, I think the progressive attorney general of that state, Jack Conway, would be a great candidate, even though so far he said that he's not going to run. So my guess is that that will end up being a very competitive race and that the DSCC, as it's called, will get involved. You know, why is he vulnerable? I think partly it's he's been around forever. I think he's been around for about five terms now, and that's, you know, about 30 years. People know that he's an insider. And more word is breaking through that he is standing against the will of his own constituents. And again, this is one of the things that has kind of aggravated progressives the most watching the policy fights of recent years. It's not as if Republican politicians in D.C. are actually representing Republican voters back home when they stand against Wall Street reform and stick up for the insurance industry and stick up for the big oil companies, or in this case, stick up for the gun manufacturers. Even people back home want Wall Street held accountable. They don't want their homes being foreclosed on. People back home don't want their kids shot in movie theaters or schools. People back home don't want to pay exorbitant prices for prescription drugs or be ripped off by big corporations. And that's why it's so important to go on offense. And that's why we've been encouraging the president to use his bully pulpit to actually force these Republicans to cave. So, you know, what we're trying to do here is basically throw salt in the wound, make an example out of Mitch McConnell, show how vulnerable even someone in the red state of Kentucky is. And the more we can get him to cave, or the more we can get his popularity to plummet back home, you know, the more ripple effects that we'll have across other politicians and across other policy fights. That's our theory.
Adam Green, co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yep. Thank you, Sam. Again, big fan of the show, and thank you for really providing a necessary perspective on all the news. I am, just for the record, I am a paid subscriber, and I encourage everybody to do their part by going online and shipping in as well.
You get one of those, buddy. There you go, Adam Green. I'm a big fan of the work you do. You know that, and also very. I don't know if I've had a chance to publicly thank you guys for all the work you did in terms of getting Elizabeth Warren elected in Massachusetts, my semi home state, former home state, definitely. But I still, all my family is still back there, so very much appreciated. And thanks for your time today,
thank
buddy.
You.
All right, bye-bye.
No problem, Sam.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the great John Amato, the proprietor of Crooks and Liars. And we'll talk about the gulp heard around the world, ladies and gentlemen, and actually talk about some of the, well, I don't know if substance is the right word that that Marco Rubio presented. But we will get to that in just a moment. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. And ladies and gentlemen, to talk about the response to the State of the Union, also the State of the Union, I went through my Rolodex and I said, who is the most hydrated, non-cottony mouth, non-flop sweat guest I can get? And then just coincidentally, he's also the proprietor of one of my favorite blogs of all time, of course, crooksandliars.com, which we check every day to steal their clips for this program. John Amato, welcome to the program, John.
Well, I thank you for that wonderful introduction. I am very well hydrated. Yes.
I'm hydrated at all times.
Yes, you always know. And the one thing that I got to say about Amato, too, is that he always keeps water within arm's reach. He never has to walk across the room while giving a national speech. We'll get to the clip of the gulp heard around the world, because you actually really can hear it. But
oh my God, yes.
First off, let me just start with your take on the State of the Union. I just heard from Adam Green from the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Just give me your take on it.
Well, you know, what's interesting about State of the Union, they're not the amount of people that watch a State of the Union isn't as great as, you know, many other campaign speeches and debates. So I think it's a little overblown when a president is giving an hour speech, how many people viewed it. I think what's really important with these speeches is if there are cutaway moments, right, that like where it's an impressive, you know, end of speech, middle, whatever he has a passion about, that will be replayed throughout the media for the next week or two in news cycles. So in that respect, you know, I think Obama, for him, it was a little more impassioned speech, State of the Union, than what I've heard in previous State of the Unions. And the fact that since he won re-election, he does seem to have an extra, you know, hop to his jump. You know, he seems much more commanding and much more in charge. And instead of being this, you know, and we've all talked about this, the first year or two, this I want to be the bipartisan president fetish really sabotaged what he was doing and took the momentum of, yes, we can change these things in Washington, and allowed then the Republicans to help sabotage everything. And then it cost him the House. So the fact is that he's learning a little bit more, and he had a little more jump in his speech. So quickly, I hate the deficit reduction talk. I can't stand it. I don't think a Democratic president should ever be talking about a balanced approach to deficit reduction and all this stuff. It drives me crazy. Outside of that, I thought that he laid down a lot of good Democratic ideas, at least, you know, we have things that we can actually discuss and talk about over the course of the next year, or, you know, the next new fiscal cliff or whatever the next policy debate is. And I saw in a way that was positive. So I thought it was overall, it was pretty good. You know, yes, I can't stand the drone strikes and the drone program. But we're talking, you know, to the vast amounts of people. And I think that there was enough in it that it helped the Democratic cause.
Yeah, I agree with you. And like I said, we're going to talk more in in this program about his troops reduction announcement and things like pre-K, which universal pre-K, which, you know, as a parent and an expectant parent, I can tell you is both something that I would love to exist today, but also having dug into and having spoken to people about the implications of pre-K education for kids going in, particularly for low-income kids who are at a massive deficit in terms of just words and things that they've been exposed to. From mid and upper income kids, that's going to make that's a huge difference. Now, it's not something that we're going to see in the next 3 years, but to the extent that we can set the compass towards that, it's a great principle to be agitating for. All right, now let's go to Rubio's speech. Give me your, let's put aside for a moment the flop sweat and the water drinking. Let's maintain the decorum and the intellectual analysis that this program is known for, and then we'll get into the other stuff, which it's also known for. But
you're the comedian, not me.
Well, I mean, arguably, you don't need to be one to make fun of that guy. Frankly, it made professional comedians out of millions of people on Twitter, it seemed like. But just let's look at this. Here's Rubio, right? He's set up to be the savior of the Republican Party, which is not, they use that term because the Republicans were using that term about Obama. What was new? What did he do that was in any way different in terms of policy now? Did he present in terms of where the Republicans are going to go now? Has he been able to turn the page?
Yes, absolutely not. You know, if you were just to delete, you know, 100 or 200 words out of his speech, you could see Mitt Romney giving that same speech. And no matter what a Washington Post writer writes about how he's the anti-Mitt Romney, that's categorically false. You cut out a paragraph or two more, you have Paul Ryan. Then you keep the speech. You can just pass it around every GOP, you know, politician, and it's the same. Nothing changed. David Frum wrote a piece basically saying he doesn't want rebranding. He wants, you know, more thought on different policies, and you don't get that. And so it's the same tried and true GOP tactic that they've used before, especially with Bush and compassionate conservatism. So, you know, and as I was watching it, because I do, you know, as you know, obviously I'm on Twitter also, but I really, you know, want to be, I try to be very pragmatic when I watch these things. I don't try to be as political. And to me, he just, that's the first thing I thought about. This could be Mitt Romney. Outside of him going to his personal story, that was the only thing that set him up differently than Romney. There was, you know, it was the same thing, blame the government. Blame, you know, Obama, if he talks about expanding, you know, helping our crumbling infrastructure, he just wants big government. If he talks about trying to help our pre-K, he's just talking about big government. It's the same tired arguments that they just lost a major election to. And to me, it was actually kind of shocking as I was watching it. And then throw on his lip smacking on top of it before he actually grabbed the water. I was really dumbfounded by what they wrote. It was boilerplate GOP.
Yeah, I mean, that was and the other thing that struck me was that he also was. Now, what was it that he was saying? Like, I'm not you know, President Obama's wrong. We don't want people to starve. We don't want people to you know, would not go to school and whatnot. The strange thing was, is like, you know, we don't want people, we don't want there to be, we want there to be clean air. We don't want to poison the air. I mean, first off, how weird is it that you have to go up there and say that when Obama has not said that? I mean, it's one thing if Obama had got out there and said, hey, the Republicans, they want to poison your air. Now, I happen to believe that the Republicans don't want to poison your air. They just don't care that it's clean. You know, that's the philosophy, right? It's like Ron Paul said during one of the debates. Like, you know, if the guy dies because he made bad decisions, then he dies. I don't think Ron Paul wants him to die. It's just that we're not responsible for those things. But when you've got to come out and say that, A, imply that you've been accused of that, and then B, just sort of like out of the blue, claim that we don't. That seems to me very problematic, right? I mean, who are you speaking to at that point?
Yes, exactly. I mean, who he's talking to is just his base, hardcore, Tea Party X, you know, GOP. To me, there is no GOP anymore. It's Tea Party. But that's beside the point. And he didn't reach anybody new. There was, you know, he's just talking to the same people that are, you know, from the resentment part of the GOP. And it's like, yeah, Obama thinks we want to kill babies. Yeah, Obama thinks we hate kids. You know, yeah. And it's like, that's not what he said. And yes, it's quite odd. In other words, he erects a straw man that's not there, and then he tries to knock it down. But maybe that's a response to the election loss. They just threw those things in there. And, you know, that was their big policy change, was to knock down what Obama won on or something. It was a bizarre strategy. I have to, you know, I would definitely say.
Let's listen to a clip from Crooks and Liars that you guys pulled of Chris Matthews, because you know, on occasion I find myself agreeing with Chris Matthews, but this time I think he really did nail it, because obviously the gulping and the sweating and the lip smacking and the lip rubbing and the sort of the sort of infomercial quality is what's getting all the play for Marco Rubio. But Chris Matthews really hit it on a policy level that there was nothing new here but petulance. Let's this clip is from that you guys pulled at Crooks and Liars. Let's play this number six.
I thought it was Tinker Toys. I thought it was primitive, something you'd hear in a high school debating team. First of all, he went after government as some kind of evil. Then he admitted that he had gone to school on student loans. Well, I went to school on student loans. My dad went to school on the GI Bill. Most of us have benefited from good government. Government's worked for us. I got in the Peace Corps, changed my life. I mean, I'm very pro-government. And he admitted he was, too. He says, I love Medicare because of how it treats takes care of my mother, how it took care of my father with dignity. He said, I went the student loan route. I benefited from it. I got my education. Where was the consistency here? I didn't get it. He was saying he's a product of solid government and positive programs, and then he just trashed the whole thing. And then he played this victim game that everybody seems to play today. What's the Republicans' victims? They're paying $1 and $6 now. We have about 15% of GDP going to revenues. We're spending 25%. Who's being overtaxed?
Yeah.
I mean, what are they talking about? It was almost like a Yaffer convention speech, Young American for Freedom speech from the 1950s. There was no originality to it. It was basic. Again, it was Tinker Toys. It was a kid's presentation of a philosophy reduced to maybe the ninth grade level. I'm sorry, that's what it was.
Yes, I mean, tell me your thoughts about that, because I think that really hits it right on the head.
No, it really did. And like I said, Chris Matthews, if anything, he is entertaining in any kind of a weird way. So, he's either you're like horrified by what he said or you agree with him. And that was an astute and and his usual no filter type explanation of what Rubio was doing, that's why I said I was completely shocked. Like, to me, the GOP, the way they're figuring they're changing is not by policies, but again, they're repackaging this rebranding. It's the same bad product, but now they put it, in a Marco Rubio package, and it's supposed to change things.
Now,
I completely agree with him. It was like a Mickey Mouse, boilerplate, resent his fear type of a speech to only the 20% of the Republicans that consider themselves Tea Parties are at 17% now.
Well, that's the interesting thing is that, first off, yes, he sounded like a well-spoken caller into this program who's, seen a clip on YouTube and just said, Reagan and just no real ideas, no policy ideas, just sort of this broad notion of we shouldn't hurt job creators. But what also struck me about that is that this is the guy who's supposed to be, he is the guy who's going to be running in 2016 to appeal to the middle, right? I mean, Rand Paul was set up, Rand Paul gave the Tea Party response, which I watched. And again, these Tea Partiers, they still cannot figure out. You put the teleprompter underneath the camera, not to the left, not to the right of it. They still haven't figured that out. But that said, this is the guy who's supposed to appeal to the middle, but he's doing essentially the exact same thing that that Romney did, which is including all these ideas of the Republican base, not deviating from the orthodoxy one bit, and just trying to sort of soften the rhetoric in some ways, but he couldn't even do that. Let's play that clip of Marco Rubio sort of complaining that he's being, people are saying that I'm mean. I'm not mean.
But anytime anyone opposes the president's agenda, he and his allies usually respond by falsely attacking their motives. When we point out that no matter how many job-killing laws we pass, our government can't control the weather, he accuses us of wanting dirty water and dirty air. When we suggest we strengthen our safety net programs by giving states more flexibility to manage them, he accuses us of wanting to leave the elderly and the disabled to fend for themselves. And tonight, he even criticized us for refusing to raise taxes to delay military cuts, cuts that were his idea in the first place. But his favorite attack of all is that those of us who don't agree with him, that we only care about rich people. Mr. President, I still live in the same working class neighborhood I grew up in.
it's just so, it's so whiny, mixed in, of course, with the sort of like the, you know, the white stuff in the corners of the lip, that, but I mean, this is again, a speech that is not being delivered to the American people. It is being delivered to conservatives. This is the exact same thing that Rush Limbaugh says every day on his program. They accuse us of being homophobes. They accuse us of hating blacks. They accuse us of hating Hispanics. We had a Hispanic to our State of the Union address. I mean, this is...
I hire Hispanics to cut my grass, for God's sake.
this is the same formula, which is to sort of say that we are being victimized by the president. And it's strange that they cannot break out of it. It, you know, it's still basically, you still cannot talk to the Republican base in this country and not sound crazy to the rest of America. And vice versa. You can't talk to the rest of America without sounding crazy to the Republican base. This is their fundamental problem.
I mean, it's like the propaganda that's been going on since Limbaugh actually, you know, started being popular, that overtook the right, that it's, you know, it's even affected the speech writers. It's, you know, I mean, and every speech is really just a speech for Republican primary voters. And it is quite stunning. And you think, you know, at times, you know, we all say, listen, Republicans really can't believe most of the stuff they say, right? They really can't believe this. So, you know, a lot of these pundits, they're getting paid money. You know, they will go to these super PACs. They don't really believe it. They don't, you know, they believe in climate change. But, hey, you know, they're getting $100,000. So they'll say, you know, so what? The North, you know, Pole is melting away. That doesn't mean anything. But you get to the point that they may obviously believe that. And it's coming from Marco Rubio. You know, that has been proven to be a false narrative. They've been running, you know, anti-Obama screeds the day, you know, as soon as he announced he was running, you know, in the Democratic primary, you know, the guys were brought up his middle name right away, you know, about Hussein, it's Hussein, he's Saddam, you know, and they immediately started attacking his name. And he's been subject to this for 5 years now, and it's failed, and it will continue to fail. And in effect, it's only going to make Obama more popular.
Yeah, I think so. And what's also, you know, you talk about the Hussein thing. What I also find funny is, like, look, it's quite obvious the guy is looking at a teleprompter, right? I mean, Rubio. I mean, this is, you know, I heard some Republicans complaining, like, oh, people paying attention to the water, you know, so you got dry mouth. Which, yeah, I mean, I've been nervous. I've done stuff on national television. I've looked like a deer in the headlights, and I've been nervous as well. But the problem is that they have is that they made Obama's first term all about that teleprompter. And so now they when they get sort of like subjected to their own creation, i.e., you know, delivery being important, it's problematic for them. And of course, you know, Rubio's looking at a teleprompter. I mean, you know, it's hilarious to me. And the other thing that I want to ask you about, we just got a couple minutes here. What is it with the Republicans? I mean, the Republicans and the Democrats seem to see the State of the Union address response differently. I remember Jim Webb's response. Jim Webb was brought there because he was, you know, a military guy and former, you know, under a Republican administration. He did a great job. But in the main, it seems to me that Democrats bring out, you know, sort of maybe a backbencher in the House. I mean, they know that it's basically a throwaway, and it's almost a gift to the person doing it. In the, for the Republicans, it has seemed, at least over the past 4 years, that this is their way to sort of break somebody out. It started with Bobby Jindal, and has moved on from there, and it inevitably is a horrible place to be. It inevitably is may have like it hinders these people's rise in the party. What is that dynamic?
Yeah, you know, I don't understand what they are thinking. You know, and yeah, look what happened to Bobby Jindal after he gave that howdy doody State of the Union response. It crushed them for years. And you know, I thought, and again, this is why optics and the gulp and the smacking of the lips do matter, because Marco Rubio, I thought, gave a great speech in the Republican convention. However, as soon as he finished his speech, then Clint Eastwood came out and started talking to the chair, and everybody forgot about Rubio. Nobody talked about. I thought Rubio's speech was very good there. It was much more powerful and effective there than it was here. But because of the Clint Eastwood chair, it got completely overshadowed. Nobody even mentioned Rubio. Today, now after last night, people are going to be seeing excerpts of him smacking his lips, grabbing the water. It's going to be an SNL skit. We have this. It's all over the internet. You know, how many millions of people watched Rubio give that? You know, maybe 2 or 5.
Right.
Well, how many people are going to see him drinking gulp water online? It's going to be millions and millions of people watching that clip and say, this is the guy that's supposed to be the savior. And to your point, it's hugely, you know, you would think that the Republicans would have learned the lesson of Bobby Jindal. But they, you know, they get so, they're into their messiah. I think they're so afraid that their brand is dwindling. And that's why they put Jindal out to offset Obama, because Obama was such a powerful speaker that they figured they have to give something to equal that, or Obama will look too good. I mean, that's the only thinking I could come out with. It's like, we need something to compete with Obama. We can't, you know, and let's do it at the State of the Union. And it's backfired now twice. You know, it's been really funny if you watch then the Republican pundits have to defend, you know, make-believe Rubio gave such a great response. But, you know, when you watch Fox last night, as soon as Rubio finished, Bret Baier came on to Fox and immediately said how difficult it is to give the response, and admitted that he was nervous, he was uncomfortable, and he didn't do a good job. But after Bret Baier said that, every other Fox guy just dismissed the gulp and said he was brilliant, because, you know, they knew that they had to try to rebuild this guy back up to something of the messiah that they want him to be.
It really is fascinating, because you when you see these attempts to sort of match Obama's charisma and just sort of you really do realize that I've disagreed with President Obama on many policies, but you do realize that he is more than just a good speaker. I mean, you really begin to realize this guy has had an abnormal amount of poise and charisma. And you see that, you know, whatever experiences he had in his life, I mean, the Republicans convinced themselves that this is a guy who's just a rookie. He went from community organizer to the presidency. He never had a job in his life, and he never had any real world experiences. I mean, the thing that becomes clear after they keep putting up failed sort of, knockoff versions of Obama in their mind is that, Obama's just, he's much more than a good speaker. There's just a level of depth there that they cannot compete with.
He's definitely improved in this respect as a presidential politician. He's finally he's been using the bully pulpit much more effectively since after the debt ceiling crisis that we had. He's finally gotten back to using his bully pulpit to make his case, and it's been much more effective. We all did, and I certainly did, when Obama won re-election in 2008, wanted him to start fireside chats because of how bad our economy was, and that by just offering putting in $1 trillion stimulus wasn't enough to explain. You know, he needed to get out there and explain to American people how devastated our economy was, how bad it would be, and that we're now going to be on the road to recovery. It was going to be difficult. But for some reason, his team maybe thought he was overexposed and didn't put him back on TV to explain this to people. It really hurt him. And now, you know, today he's giving speeches. He's going around again. He's not going to do a Bush, where Bush completely failed because people don't want their Social Security messed with. But I think he's learned, you know, after that experience, you know what, this bully pulpit is a powerful thing that I have.
Yeah, it really is. It's encouraging.
Words matter.
and it's encouraging, and particularly for the midterms, just so that you don't have Democratic candidates running against the president, that you can actually that he can become a sort of a wind at their backs, as opposed to some type of obstacle to genuine Democratic principles. John.
Yeah, and remember, a lot of blue dogs lost in 2010.
Yes, so we're looking at, hopefully, if we can take back the House, we can see a much more a stronger progressive caucus within the context of the Democratic Party. John, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, my friend.
All right. John Amato, crooksandliars.com, folks. Do yourself a favor. If you want to know what clips we're going to be playing on that show today, you go to Crooks and Liars in the morning. That's what, I mean, that's not 100% true. We always credit it.
Always. We always credit every site. That's true.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break and head into the better half of our program there. We will play The Gulp Heard Around the World. And also, Rubio showed up on this morning talking about the minimum wage. We will talk about the minimum wage with some measure of depth. It is a very important policy, and also recount the notion of pre-K, and we'll get to that Ron Paul story where he's teamed up with the black helicopters and the blue helmets, folks, to attack his own people. It's just a matter of time. We all know when they go around the UN, they go around. I think still they – I don't know if they send the kids around with UNICEF things during Halloween – but we do know they are probably still involved in fluoridating the water and putting stuff into the candy that you get at Halloween via their orange boxes that they used to carry around to poison your mind. And it's possible that Ron Paul ingested too much of that.
Is the one true that there's invasion plans for the UN? There's maps on the backs of cereal boxes that give them maps as to how to invade the United States?
Yes. No, that, of course, is true. Yes. In certain certain cereals, of course, organic cereals, if you buy enough cereal boxes and you piece them together, you actually can see the route that the UN plans to take. Obviously, it emanates out of New York, but they also have a secret tunnel, I think, that goes, like, well into perhaps, like, into New Jersey. Then you take a left, I think, down to Delaware. And that's the way they're going to that's the way they get to the South really quickly, because people will be watching the UN blue helmets march across the George Washington Bridge, and they get faked out because of the secret tunnels.
You never knew the amount of information on the back of your Kashi box, hippies.
That's right.
Well, I mean, they put a map on the back of the Constitution.
Really?
In the that movie, the Disney movie. Forget it.
All right.
With what's-his-face.
Nick Cage, right?
Nick Cage, yes.
I'm trying to help you out here, buddy.
I didn't have no idea what you're talking about. All right, folks. Kashi. We'll take a break. You want to call the program, 646-257-3920. Should I talk about this? I've got like one particular Twitter troll that is it's just fascinating.
The one who keeps attacking you for being a...
An emo prog.
Stop whining, Sam. Got over drones are like so first half of 2012, bro.
All right. We'll take a break. 646-257-3920. We got a special non-emo prog line opened up at 646-257-3920 today. If you are a just a prog, not an emo prog, or a not a firebagger, but just a non-firebagger, you can call us at 646-257-3920. And
if you own ronpaul.com, you could reach us at
646-3920. And, of course, I will unleash the IM machine. I have yet to do that. Apologies, folks. Sorry about that. And we'll be back in just a moment.